time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Hello and welcome to this. Well, it's not really a breaking news episode of what most people think. It's more a special episode, a one-off. Happy Starmiversary. I hope good wishes to all after a year. So the election was July the 4th, but today is July the 5th. So I thought I would do an episode looking back at, you know, Labour's first year, how they came into power, what they promised, and, well, why they just somehow, despite scoring a majority of about 170, they felt so on the back foot. I mean, they're literally like, you know, one of those couples that have a massive, massive wedding, you know, throw like 20, 30 grand at it, and then 2 months later, here, well, they're on the rocks. It's happened very, very quickly for Labour. And, you know, we'll get into all of that. But, I mean, there was no greater metaphor for what's been going on than Wednesday. So Labour on Tuesday, I did the episode earlier this week with Simon Brockin, and rebellion was brewing and it had been quelled. And then it brewed again and then they had more concessions. Then it brewed up again. And then in real time, on the floor of the House, they made another concession, which I think even shocked the rebels. Like, you know, when you make mum and dad like lose their shit, that look in kids' face, like, oh my God, oh, I'm not even sure I wanted this. And so, like, you know, the economic plans, their credibility, you know, they've had to U-turn on a lot of things, but economically they've had to U-turn on winter fuel and now on this welfare package. And then you've got Labour MPs out doing this thing. You know, this thing that Labour MPs increasingly do where they piss on your shoulder and tell you it's raining. So they say, you know, actually, this is still a really good bill. We've taken on, we've listened to what was said, but it's not the same bill that you put forward. It's not in any way the same bill that you put forward. But anyway, right, so this eventually gets voted through, but there's still a sizable rebellion. And then cut to Wednesday, and at PMQs, you know, as it would have been seen all over the country, possibly, you know, around the world, is that the Chancellor was crying. Now, like, immediately the perception was, given that 24 hours and the week that she'd had and the month that she'd had, that it was a work-related issue. That's not an unreasonable assumption for the public. And a lot of journalists to come to is that, what has he told her before PMQs, that it's over, or is she quitting? Like, what is going on here, right? And so Starmer, spectacularly, heedlessly, just is one of the only people in the chamber not to fucking notice this. I know the people behind her couldn't see, but, like, he's sitting next to her, more or less. But Cammy Badenoch asked for assurances that she'll be in her post. And rather than sort of think, well, why is the leader of the opposition talking about the fact I've got a miserable chancellor? Should I have a little check? Should I see what's going on? Should I back my chancellor? Because she's asked if she'll still be here in a year. Should I back my chancellor? No, he gets up and makes a crap joke and doesn't back his chancellor at all. And then whatever it was that was making her cry, it does seem to make it worse. And then there's an absolute shit show afterwards. You know, like, initially, Labour coming out saying it's a personal matter, but then there are sort of credible accounts that she'd had a couple of run-ins with the speaker. But the line that they've stuck to since is that it's a personal matter. And look, I don't know what's going on in her life, and if there's difficult things, of course you don't want to see any human being cry, and you hope that whatever it is can be resolved to best effect. But when you're the Chancellor, like, you're the Chancellor, you're in public. I mean, literally, bond markets were affected by this, the currency dipped. This is, like, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because there were journalists kind of saying, especially female journalists saying, you know, well, because of all the misogynistic tropes about women crying, this is a really difficult one. It's not that difficult. You have to talk about it. You don't have to be cruel about it. But public life is public life. You know, we don't definitely have a right to know what it is that's going on. It might not even be Rachel Reeves's right to share the information of what's going on. But the moment the national currency moves, that you cannot not talk about it. And for fuck's sake, we literally spent 2 weeks talking about the fact a bloke didn't use an umbrella not that long ago, and the fact that he was moaning about Sky Sports. You know, so like it's been a weird week. Like I say, nobody wants to see another. I mean, a lot of people will say that, you know, Rachel Reeves' policies have caused them pain and stuff. But if someone genuinely has a personal matter. But it is impossible to think that there won't be press scrutiny on this, all right? People call it being brutal. It's not being brutal. Like, the cost of government borrowing went up. It fell back down, but it went up. So, look, I wish all the best, you know, in her personal life, but it has to be discussed. Okay, new patrons. Remember, if you are a patron, you get the podcast early, ad-free, and with bonus content. And you're getting two episodes every single week, one way or another, whether it's breaking news or the Patreon only. We've got some brilliant names this week. So, by the way, it was the first of the month. So, if you've changed your debit card or whatever you were set up with, just double-check that the account is still active. We've got a lot of names to roast here. Ben Aston. I mean, that goes down to Ian Stanley. Stanley Knife. Aston Villa. Is Villa coming, eh? Is Villa, because his name's Aston. Aston, yeah, we get it. Villa. Jason Seagrave, I mean, he sounds like somebody that was on the kind of like, you know, the kind of, you know, those tents at Glastonbury that John Peel would have once recommended bands for. And Jason Seagrave is going to be playing there. Was there accusations about John Peel? Were they proved? I don't know. I heard stuff. Anyway, I'll put that one over to David Demain. Jonathan Sturgeon. Jonathan Sturgeon. I mean, that is proper MP name, isn't it? You know, a guy, Jonathan Sturgeon, just a really good, solid backbencher. Worked very hard for the people of Wenley and Shippo. Jonathan, so one of the few Tories that kept their seats comfortably because he does a bloody good job. We've also got Niall Clark-Petty. Niall Clark-Petty. I mean, I suppose in a double-barreled name, you'd have to go that way around. Petty Clark. Just sounds like a criticism. Again, you know, if these are, I mean, the thing with double barrel names, is it, did you take on some of your wife's name? Because that is unacceptable. I don't want to sound like a pub landlord, but that is, get out. Niall Clark-Petty, welcome. Sarah Lloyd-Davis, another one. I mean, Sarah, what are you, some sort of feminist? What are you, Emily Pankhurst, are you with your double... Look, there might be totally legitimate reasons, but I reserved the right to roast, so welcome Sarah Lloyd-Davis, and we got Anthony Ray. Quicker than a ray of light. That would be his thing on the stag do. He'd have his own theme tune. Quicker than a ray of light. And then somebody would overcommit to it and like, quicker than a... All right, Steve. That's enough. David Demain, who is the super patron who keeps an eye on previous weeks. And I kind of forgot to mention, there was so much good stuff in his last email that I want to go back to it. Things he brought up. Theresa May, get this is a good fact. Theresa May earned 1.8 million for doing speeches in the 2 years after leaving Downing Street, according to Business Insider reports. I'll tell you something. If Theresa May, because we're talking about MPs and PM salary, I guess, if she can earn 1.8 million, I would give it a go. 1.8 million. I suppose what she's got is a narrative that maybe people are broadly sympathetic to, is that, you know, when she took charge of the Tory party, they were fighting like cats in a bag, right? I don't know whether Liz Truss is going to be able to command the same sort of fees. I mean, unless it's like... you know the guy that does the David Brent lookalike? Mate, if she could do her own lookalike, she could turn up as like a comedy Liz Truss, sort of dressed in a green dress that has sort of lettuce markings on it. She could do all right like that, just turn up as like an ironic comedy booking. Rishi Sunak, I think maybe because he held that AI summit in London. Again, there might be some sympathy that he came in a bad time and did a good job, but he could. The other thing he could do, Rishi Sunak, is he could give people sort of lessons on how not to do a complete PR fuck up. You know, here's what I learned about not flying back from V-Day. Nigel Farage is a normal Farage. Oh, right. So I was saying that Nigel Farage called himself Nigel Farage to sound more working class. And David said, Farage is a Norman French surname, hence the pronunciation. Or if you're Sir Keir, it's very sinusy. Farage. David says, like, David says that Keir says it like he's blowing into a hanky. That's very true. Nigel Farage. That just words with Kissed Up that he just struggles to get out of his mouth. What most people think. The thank you and the fuck you. So the thank you is sort of a bit of a mental health one. Is that weird? I've been having a strange one recently. Is that my mum passed, I mentioned, with Simon Brodkin 17 years ago. So that's 2009. And this year, I don't know why, like, the anniversary is always a tough one, but this year, my God, it's felt like it was yesterday. It's really weird. I felt like I've almost been going through it again. It's a very strange thing. So I just thought I'd share that, because I know that, particularly with blokes, I think, but not exclusively, is that blokes feel very unsettled by grief. It makes you feel weak. It makes you feel vulnerable. And when feelings come around many years afterwards and you can't work out what they are, it can freak you the fuck out. So if anyone else is going through that, I just thought I'd say it and maybe you'd feel like you're going less mad, because I thought I was going mad. I was like 17 years. but I also wanted to excuse to tell you something about my mum. You know, like, you got to do the positives after a while. And I've spoken about my dad a lot on this podcast because he's got better stories. Right, but that doesn't mean he was funnier. My dad was a good public speaker, but my mum was just naturally funny, right? Naturally funny woman. And on her way out, we always say that, on her way out, but in her final days, right, she was in bed, you know, the family were around, and anyone that's been through that would know, you know, it's an exhausted, difficult thing, but she was so funny even in that period. She did this little, I think she got it off, I don't know, Two Ronnies or Monty Python, but she did this extended mime where she pretended to thread a needle and put it through her top lip. And she went through all this, like, she really committed to the bit. And then once it, like, tied the imaginary thread off at the end. And once she got it to a point, she then just pulled the imaginary thread and made her lip move to make it look like there was a thread there. I mean, it's just such a fucking bizarre, random thing to do. But that was Jan. So listen, I just want to sort of raise a metaphorical glass to my mum. And the fuck you is to cricket. So I went to cricket yesterday. I went to see the second day of England versus India. And even if you don't know much about cricket, you might be aware of this thing called Bazball, right? The idea that this period of cricket, for English cricket, is one of the most exciting there's ever been. The team are just going out there, going shit for bust, you know, scoring loads of runs, trying to take wickets, you know. So it's been some of the most exciting cricket that's ever happened in this country, Test cricket. I've been to about 4 days of cricket since COVID, Test cricket. Each one of them has been the most boring. The most boring. So yesterday, India put on about 300 for five, you know, under four and over. England come out, lost a few wickets, then had to drop anchor. I just thought, is it me? Am I the fucking Jonah? Now, don't get me wrong, I'd still rather go to a bad day's cricket than a good day's rugby. But there you go. There'll be letters for that one. What have you got against rugby? A lot. Okay, right, now we get to the main point of this podcast. So after a year of Labour government, 1 year of hard Labour, let's go back to the start.
Thank you so much for that reception. What an amazing reception. We did it!
Yep, they did it. On the morning of July the 5th, Labour swept into office with a fucking massive majority. Nearly 170. It turns out it's not as big as Blair's in 97, but huge, right? And so we're going to start, right, reviewing their year. And let's just start with the positives, okay? Because I think that might be a bit quicker. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for the financial mess that Labour inherited. The Tories got a bad one in 2010, but I think this was demonstrably worse because we've had austerity, you know, with there's certain baked-in elements of low growth and stuff like that. I think that the Tories handed over the justice system in a mess, right? I do think that, you know, it was they basically put it at the very back of the garage and thought, you know what, the next people are moving can clear that out. Things were internationally volatile and set to get more volatile, so I've got sympathy for that. I mean, it does beg the question, though, of why, given that the next 5 years, a lot of it was clearly going to be about foreign policy because of what was going on in Gaza and what was going on in Russia. But, you know, we had an election campaign where we spoke about, as I say, you know, umbrellas, Sky TV, Diane Abbott. That was the only point that Labour were really pressed on. The debates barely mentioned international issues. But I think, you know, you have to say that the inheritance Labour got was pretty shit. The question is whether or not they've taken that inheritance, that meagre inheritance, and invested it in some kind of like random crypto that went bust after a week. And I think there is a strong argument for that. And, you know, and in the campaign, it was made like their entrance into office was created by the Tories, because the Tories, even after, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the polls, even after Partygate, they were still ahead or, you know, sort of level. And I think that the first point where Labour started to overtake was the Owen Paterson affair. Am I right here? Maybe. The first time Labour overtook was Owen Paterson in 2021, right? But we'd been through COVID, and there were times in COVID where people felt that the Tories had been so bad that COVID alone would see them out of office. But they'd recovered. We had the COVID bounce. And then they helped out their mate Owen Paterson in 2021. People didn't like that. And then I think Partygate broke in December 2021, right? And from then on, like, it was, they were sort of 6 points. And even then, they were only like 6 points ahead. But, you know, Boris just kept on sort of lying about stuff. And I think there was that famous photo, wasn't there, of Boris, of the cabinet just looking at him. And it was after, he'd lied about not knowing about Chris Pincher. That was it, the handsy guy. And there was the whole picture of the cabinet at the time, Suella, Rishi, Pretty, the old timers, the greats, all looking at him like, this bloke's never going to stop lying, is he? But I tell you what, they would have killed to be just six points behind now. I'm not saying that was a reason not to sack him, but, you know, it didn't get much better for them. So, you know, Keir Starmer, who hadn't been an MP that long, really, only become an MP in 2015, he's sort of leading them into a campaign which they can't lose. Oh, but they're still terrified to lose, because that's been said before. And consequence of that was that they just pledged to do very little. I mean, weirdly, apart from to have the highest growth in the G7, which for the first quarter of this year we have had. Enjoy it while it lasts, because, you know, I don't like to be a pessimist, but I'm not sure that's going to happen again for a while. And they pledged to smash the gangs. They're going to smash the gangs, because that played into, that gave him an opportunity to do that thing that he hated talking about so much, which was that he worked, I don't know if you know him, but he was a director of public prosecution, so he doesn't like to bring it up. It's like me performing in Afghanistan for the troops. I don't really like to mention it. But he said, we're going to smash the gangs. So they got rid of the Rwanda policy, right? And I thought that was a bad policy, personally. But the numbers this year of small boat crosses suggest that, I don't know, maybe on some level was a mad deterrent. It did work. But overall, they didn't commit to a great deal. It's more about what they wouldn't commit to, which was we're not gonna increase taxes. We're not going to increase taxes on working people. And so that meant VAT, income tax, and national insurance. But when we say working, just to be clear, that's got a silent asterisk. Well, I guess what they didn't do was, you know, they didn't strike a deal with the British public, particularly. I mean, Starmer himself, what was it he said in his acceptance speech? Unburdened by doctrine. And that's kind of like saying, untroubled by having a clear direction. You know, I'm not going to be held back by having a clear view of things, all right? I mean, it's all about how you read these things. Pragmatism is good, but if that's all you've got, that's not a direction. That is you're basically like an administrator. I've said it before. I mean, I thought this about Sunak and Hunt, but I think it more about the Labour administration, is that they do feel like when a club is up the wall financially, you just bring in the administrators, and they don't really have a view on things. They just run things like on a basic common sense level, devoid of kind of emotional or sense of mission. And that has been how it's felt under Labour. Starmer, you know, wasn't good in debates at all. Lost all of them, I think, really, more or less. You know, that was a time when Rishi Sunak was really unpopular, and still, even Labour voters, quite a lot of them were saying that Sunak was better in debates. And you know, who cares about debates, right? But they were a sign of how nimble is this guy. How nimble is he? Well, not that nimble. I mean, you know, what happened this week in the Commons with Rachel Reeves was an example of that, just not alive to circumstances. He's about as nimble as like a 90-year-old that slept on the floor. That's as nimble. He just cannot, the kind of guy that could not go off the script. You get that with some comedians. They basically have a script. Some comedians, something happens in the room, they can react to it. Some of them are literally like, could I carry on doing my jokes, please? And he's that kind of comic, right? And it was weird, because it's easily forgotten that the polling in the build-up to the election was about between 40 and 50%. I mean, some of those MRP polls were sort of saying that Labour was going to be a super majority, wasn't it? It's going to be like Labour going to get 500 seats. But they ended up with 34% of the vote. A lot of seats, but 34% of the vote. So it kind of felt like they started off with a bit of a repudiation. There was an opportunity. No one likes the Tories anymore. You're the obvious alternative. Sell us something. And over a period of weeks, they did. And then in the end, only just over a third or around a third of people voted for them. And given how bad the Tories had been, that was not a great start. And what with that and the low turnout, you know, they sort of, it was both a landslide, but a very, just a fair, it just didn't feel like any of the houses or buildings moved.
What most people think.
So the speech was, you know, and it was what a lot of people wanted to hear after, even if you were a Tory supporter, you couldn't deny that, you know, there'd been a lot of shambolic politics from Brexit onwards, really, but particularly in the year of three prime ministers. So the speech, you know, we're not going to be governed by doctrine. Well, you'd say that with their first moves, you know, slapping VAT on private schools, taxing business. I mean, some fairly old school Labour doctrine. And they also, the thing that always bugged me was that Starmer said, it's not going to be as chaotic as before. This is going to be a politics that treads more lightly on your lives. And I just felt there was a little bit of complacency there, thinking somehow that the Tories had been deliberately shit. Right? It's forgetting that, I guess, running any Western democracy in the 2020s with a lot of low growth around and countries sort of seeming to need high immigration to fill certain jobs, but also struggling to square that circle with the voters. Like, there's a lot of hard stuff. You know, there's already rolling news media, but now there's social media. There's a sort of freneticness to public life. Politicians get a lot more shit now. It's a worse job since the expenses scandal. It's not as lucrative as it were. So they kind of, it was almost like they thought, well, now it's us. Everything's going to be all right. Go, yeah, some of the reasons that the Tories were shit were kind of baked in. And, you know, their messaging very early on was like, they realised, you know, they were sat down and told about the scale of the problems, you know, with you know, in the Treasury. And it must be really annoying to find out there's fuck all money. Like, you've waited all that time to get in office and you think of, right, it's my turn. And they go, yeah, you're not going to be able to do much. You probably have to do loads of really unpopular shit, really. You're going to be hated at the end of the day. You're going to be hated. Are you quite resilient, yeah? You better grow another skin, mate. It's going to be a rough 5 years. And because they were so resentful, I think, over how well the Tories had parlayed the 2010 accession with that note from Liam Byrne saying, sorry, there's no money left, and they'd used that particularly well in the first few years. And they sort of thought, well, we'll do the same. We'll do a bit of austerity light. We'll keep reminding the public that there's no money, and that's going to work. But what they hadn't factored in, and this is where this Labour government have been repeatedly not quite as smart as they think they are, is that just how much time has it elapsed between then? And also that in 2010, you know, the Cameron had run on a sort of austerity ticket. That was the message, was you got to fix the roof. And all the public had bought into that. The public just hadn't bought into what Labour were going to do because they hadn't really told anyone. But their King's Speech, right, it was, had quite a bit in that, didn't it, about planning. I mean, I still think that's potentially one of their biggest successes if they can hold their nerve, is to be more bold on planning. Workers' rights, now, whether or not, you know, that's going to help stymie the jobs market even further. But Angela Rayner, you know, that's her one, workers' rights, love for workers' rights. People, you know, people, I mean, I haven't read it in great detail, but I'm guessing that you can probably claim sick leave after you've been working there about 5 minutes. And it was interesting. I was listening. And by the way, you know, I've been sort of listening to other stuff in advance of doing this. There's a really good one, a documentary. Is it a documentary? But by Henry Zefferman on BBC. And he was talking to Louise Hay, who was originally Transport Secretary. And what she said about Starmer was interesting. Is she said that he delegates a lot of stuff, right? Well, you get the impression with several people, he's not actually that interested in detail. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because he's the forensic guy. He's a forensic. Because people thought he was forensic just because when Boris Johnson was obviously lying, he successfully cross-examined the most obvious fucking liar in history. They gave him all this credit. Hey, look at him, he's forensic. He's so forensic. Ooh, be more forensic. But yeah, it seems that he sort of felt that if he delegated and put square pegs in square holes, he could just let people kind of get on with it. And the thing that comes through like time and time again is that Labour were not that ready for government. You know, even people within the movement have said that themselves. And you sort of saw it with some of the early messaging. Like with winter fuel allowance, I've said plenty on that about how that just seemed to the public to come out of nowhere, how they didn't lay the track and all that kind of stuff. But what the problem with that was, it seemed like they almost couldn't wait to do that because they'd made their new friends in the markets. You know, we're like, we're the stable ones. The Tories are chaotic. Tell you how stable we are. We'll cut fuel for pensioners. That's what we'll do. You know, it's almost like, you know, when you're showing off to your new mates while your old ones are thinking, well, you've changed. And then we had the freebie gate, right? And the thing with Freebiegate was that it, the problem was it was cheap. That was the problem, wasn't it? Because from their point of view, they're going, hang on, some of these Tories have given their mates contracts in the VIP lane for COVID. You know, some of them are, you know, toadying up to big business. And I get it. Like, there is an injustice there that you're comparing a free pair of glasses to potentially millions of pounds. But that's the problem, in a way. Hung for a lamb as well as a sheep, right? It was cheap. You might as well have made yourself rich out of it. That's the point. Because the public need to make sense of simple stories. And a bloke wearing glasses paid for him by a rich bloke, it's kind of fucking embarrassing. And he, because it's sort of, what is that old Oscar Wilde quote about a woman, whether or not a woman would sleep with him, and then eventually she says yes for a price, and he says, now we've established what you are, we're just haggling about the price. I mean, we always laugh at those. Was it Noel Coward or someone? Anyway, it's one of those witty fellas from that era. And I always imagine that people are like, oh, well done. But that woman just fucking slapped him hard around the face. What the fuck are you saying I'm a slave? But isn't that, so then eventually, like, Starmer, he said, I followed the rules, forensically, I followed the rules. And the public going, well, we don't care about the rules. You rode in a very high horse, you said you're going to be totally different from them. You're not as bad as them, but you've sort of put yourself on the same spectrum. And then he paid it back. And you go, well, now you've just made it worse, because is the juice worth the squeeze? They've basically gone, let's do the squeeze and let's get pretty much no juice. And then, I don't know if this is chronologically correct now, but then Sue Gray goes, she's his chief of staff. This is a big deal. I get, you know, what most people think. I'm trying to talk largely about the things that the public will remember. I don't know if they would know that much about or think that much about Sue Gray. But, you know, it was a big deal, chief of staff. And it did remind me of the circumstances in which they got her. You know, a permanent secretary within the civil service taking a party political role was never a great look, I didn't think. I did wonder whether or not they were just trolling the Tories just to wind them up, because she'd obviously overseen the investigation into Partygate. And they, remember those defections? I can't remember. There was that quite UKIP-y Tory MP that just randomly walked across the chamber. I mean, it was so emasculating for Rishi Sunak. I know this is really primitive and brutal, but just a woman just walking across from your side to another man. Literally just penis shrinking in real time. And she was supposed to, like, be the one, the fixer, the insider that just knew how to get through stuff with the civil service. But she was, she started getting political. His briefing started against her again, you know, with the freebies and the briefing. You're going, some of this feels like the previous lot a little bit. And she was supposed to be really organised, but they entered government without really a big plan. And, you know, then, I mean, they were just then rocked by things. Louise Hay was sacked, the transport secretary, because she, it was something to do with fraud, but she'd also, and this is forgotten, that she'd sort of indirectly suggested that people should boycott a company that the government were trying to win a contract with. Tulip Sadiq, is that her name? The MP, a London Labour MP that was being investigated by Bangladesh for fraud. I mean, it just started to build up, didn't it? You know, when they had the budget, the national insurance rise. I mean, it was a surprise, that, because they toadied up to business, hadn't they? They had a lot of smoked salmon and scrambled eggs, and Rachel Reeves was their gal. And then, you know, the NI pledge, I mean, the kind of jobs that it really affects the most, because they changed the lower threshold too, was like young people and part-timers. And yes, it didn't go against the actual wording of what they'd pledged on not raising taxes for working people. But as Martin Lewis said, it was in breach of the spirit. And if Martin Lewis said you're in breach of the spirit of something, he's so nice. That's basically like he's calling you like an absolute prick to your face. Then Keir Starmer got a bit of credibility back. You know, went over, this was the day before the Oval Office bust up, but he went over, everyone was terrified. Let's not forget, right, credit to Keir, everyone was terrified that basically Trump was going to pull his pants down and just make him look, possibly literally, and make him look stupid. Lammy would get told off, you know. But in the end, it was just a slight sort of a spat with Starmer and J.D. Vance. And Trump genuinely seemed to like Keir Starmer. Sometimes I think in the same way that you might like a pet, you know. You just think, yeah, this Starmer guy is quite cute. He's such an ass kiss, I love it. And then, you know, Starmer famously pulled out I've got a letter from the king. And he created a rapport with Donald Trump. Now, depending on how you view Trump, creating an instant rapport with Trump is not necessarily a good testament to your character, is it? It might be on the level of, you know, when people like live on the street of a serial killer, when they go, I always got on well with him. You go, don't say that in public. Say he was wrong and say you knew all along. You know, and then there's this deal with the US. Still, that's kind of being signed piecemeal. You know, like Starmer went straight in with the letter. I think we should have just done that, which Trump said, oh, you know, it'd be like a reward for chores. We'll do 5 stars each and then you go to the next level. And then if you're even nicer and you de-escalate your tariffs, we'll give you a river view, you know, Windsor Castle. But he went straight in there, whereas Trump has made Starmer, he sort of breadcrumbed him, as the kids would say. The India trade deal, in fairness, just seemed to be genuinely impressive. You know, access to local procurement. So, you know, credit where credit's due. The Tories talked about it for years, never did it. Labour did it. But the problem is, you know, do people give a shit about overseas stuff? Not so much. Then there was this kind of sequence of U-turns. First up on grooming gangs, right? And again, you know, another example, all the squeeze, none of the juice, seemed to be against it. And then employed somebody who he thought wouldn't recommend it. Then they recommended it and he was up shit street. So that was and then, of course, you know, and then they U-turned on winter fuel as well. And it was this Labour pissing on your shoulder but telling you it's raining thing where they're going, yeah, the reason that we've been able to U-turn on fuel is actually because we've fixed the economy. Is it? I thought it's just because you realise everyone fucking hated you for it. But oh, it turns out the economy's fixed, everybody. So, you know, I think the public get increasingly wary of these explanations. And then there was the rebellion on welfare. And, you know, none of his MP seems to think it was fair. He initially dismissed it as they're just noises off. Noises off. I mean, it's one of the most historical misreadings of the scale of something. You know, it's just noises off. You know, I bet that was what the Russian aristocrats thought when they asked him about the revolution that was brewing. It's just noises off. This will blow over, I promise you. And then, you know, we get to, you know, the last week, which has felt particularly chaotic. We've had a chancellor, you know, crying in the Commons. Whatever the reason is for it, you know, the sort of symbolic value of that is pretty hefty. And, you know, in recent breaking news, Zara Sultana, it seems, might be starting a party with Jeremy Corbyn, though. So there might be a splintering on the left. The problem with this government is that first impressions count, right? And the first impression of this government was that they were angry. They were just angry. There was no hope. They didn't really allow for any hope. They wanted to tell the Tories off. But that felt like everybody was sort of being told off in a way. There was like a lack of mission. We'd been sold a version of the party, which I think in a way was dishonest now because, you know, the way that they voted on welfare, the way that they've pressured on pensioners' benefits and stuff suggests that they haven't changed at all. They've got no stomach, this version of the Labour Party, to look at reducing state, you know, help, right? That sounds bad. Sounds like I'm an evil bastard. But, you know, a lot of people accept that the numbers are going up dramatically and something needs to be done. But that was the problem. You know, what was at the very front of the party, Starmer, Reeves and, you know, West Street to an extent. Was that representative of the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party? Was that representative of the unions or activists who generally can't countenance any reforms to NHS or welfare? You know, they probably still think all the same stuff they thought under Corbyn. They just realised that Corbyn maybe wasn't the guy to do it. And Starmer's left with, you know, he's got no mission. He had no mission in the first place. He's got no capacity to be radical anymore. He doesn't seem to have any power. Not any power, but, you know, he doesn't seem to have much power despite a large majority. Like I say, they inherited a shit show, no doubt, but they sort of turned it into like a cabaret of feces. And he disowns decisions. He disowns his own comments on Islands of Strangers. He regrets hiring Sue Gray, you know, regrets not doing a national inquiry on grooming gangs. I just think this guy, bit by bit, turn by turn, each stage, no doubt in his mind because of pragmatism, has ended up just not really standing for much at all. I don't think it's good for this country if Starmer goes. I don't even think it's good for this country if Reeves goes. So for the sake of the country, I sort of hope they sort it out. If you think I'm just joyfully beating up on the Labour Party, possibly a little bit of that, but actually it's in all our interest for them to sort it out, because if they get rid of Starmer and Reeves, I'll tell you what, the next lot are going to be even worse. Okay, so there it is, a special episode, A Year of Hard Labour. What do you think? Was I too harsh there? I tried to be balanced. I don't know. But do message in whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com if you want to feedback. Remember, leave 5-star reviews, please, especially on Spotify and on iTunes. And I will be back early next week. Who have we got? We've got a great guest. Oh, we've got a surprise guest next week. You might not necessarily have heard of him, but a bit like Tom Stade, every once in a while I pick out people who've been doing great things on the comedy circuit, and this comic in particular, one of the most controversial I've ever worked with.